Fasten your time machine belts. We're entering a portal to the past to discover erstwhile episodes and historical happenings. Broadcast by KYMN Radio, produced by the Northfield History Center, and hosted by Cosmo Esplin, this is Trek Through Time. Greetings, loyal listeners. Thank you very much for trekking through time with me today. I'm your host, Cosmo Esplin. I appreciate you tuning in to a brand new episode of Triple T. I'm very excited to touch on our subject for this month, our Axis of Antiquity, with not one, but two very special guests. But, of course, as I learned from the Master of Suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, I'm not going to tell you exactly what the subject or the guests are for a few more minutes, so you'll have to listen to me ramble on for just a little bit longer. I would like to wish everyone a very happy May. Spring is indeed the renewal of life, as not-so-dramatic Minnesotans call it. And with that comes a ton of new opportunities for folks. I would like to particularly single out the Star Wars fans. Yesterday was May the 4th Be With You Day, a personal favorite holiday of mine, other than Pi Day, of course. And also, happy Cinco de Mayo to everyone. Talk about historic days. Cinco de Mayo is a very important holiday for many. Of course, with May comes plenty of opportunities for community engagement, and the Northfield History Center is at the heart of that. So, that's right, it's time to look at some timely tidings. Wow, has jazz ever really changed? So the Northfield History Center has been blessed with a calendar chock full of exciting and eventful events. A week ago from today, they held their grand opening for the new exhibit focusing on Doug, Mr. Puppet Peterson. Doug Peterson was there himself, and he was able to greet some of his old students and friends and colleagues. So it was a successful way to introduce the community to the exhibit. So if you want even more details on the exhibit and the story behind it, then you can check out last month's show that I did. I interviewed Doug Peterson himself and his wife Mary Kay, both wonderful people. I really enjoyed our discussion, so you can stream that on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and a few other places. It really is magical how I'm able to work in a plug for my show every single time. And also, if you're the type of person that can't stop reading World War I books, but you don't have anyone interested to talk to about it, then you should definitely consider joining the Northfield History Center Book Club. So if you're interested in that, then email the History Center or interact with them on social media. It's a great opportunity. In alignment with that theme of exciting events and new beginnings, St. Olaf College will be holding their annual commencement celebration on May 24th at 1 o'clock p.m. at Melby Lawn on campus. One of the highlights is the St. Olaf Band, the choir, and the orchestra all performing, the big three as they call them. So if you have a loved one who's heading off into the world with ambition, or you just want to see some crazy talented musicians perform, then you should check out the commencement celebration. It's open to the public, and it's a fantastic tradition that's gone on for a long time. So perhaps that gave you a clue as to what the topic we will be focusing on this month is. Cue the Jeopardy theme song. All right, have you come up with your answer? The correct answer to Final Jeopardy is, drumroll please, what is the St. Olaf Band? And I know I kind of made it seem like there's a Jeopardy theme to this, but there's really not. It's just the St. Olaf Band, which is by itself quite an expansive topic that I am very excited to dig into. In fact, this is going to be a two-part conversation. Today's show will focus on the overview of the band and its history, and then tomorrow they'll be sitting down with another special guest to look more in detail at the band's last couple of years. But let's start with the bird's eye view of this, if you will. So the Symphonic St. Olaf Band was founded in 1891, one of Northfield's oldest institutions, and the band really sprung from Carltonian ambitions, but we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Across its 134-year career, the band has had 8 conductors, which included F. Mealy's Christensen, as well as Andrew Onstad, J. Arndt Berg, Donald Berglund, Bruce Howden, Miles Johnson, Timothy Marr, and Henry Dorn. All of these conductors who led the band into distinct eras have contributed to a thriving culture of strong standards and vibrant musicality. The band has really evolved into a central fixture of the Northfield and St. Olaf community and is now world-renowned for its high-caliber members and rich resume. In fact, The New Yorker actually called it, quote, one of America's preeminent bands. High praise indeed. So it's kind of hard to look at just a general overview of this topic, really, because it's packed full of highlights across the years. I'll just name a couple of them. Multiple tours. In fact, they were the first American college instrumental band to conduct an international tour. Their tours have included visiting Norway, Australia, Japan, and multiple other countries. They've also performed at several festivals and sought out venues across the years, including England's Aldeburgh Festival and Carnegie Hall. They have also commissioned several pieces to be exclusively composed for the band, including from David Maslanka and other high-level musical grandmasters. The band received the 2021 American Prize for Small College Band Programs, and they have also released 9 CD recordings across the years, which have been subject to worldwide attention. And I'm not done yet, this is probably the most important of all, they have afforded innumerable students once-in-a-lifetime opportunities and experiences over 134 years, creating both musical and historical traditions that are still practiced and respected to this day at the campus, which have left an indelible mark on Ole culture and the Northfield community that is really quite difficult to articulate. In 2019, By All Means Graphics here in town published Milestones and Memories of the St. Olaf Band, 1891 to 2018. The authors happen to be my guests today, Susan M. Vistendahl and Jeffrey M. Sove. I'm so excited to get Susan and Jeff's perspective on writing a 600-page book on the St. Olaf Band, also the only biography of the band that has been published in the band's history, believe it or not. I met Susan just last year. I have all 3 of her Historic Happenings books, plus the St. Olaf Band book, so hopefully I am admitted into her fan club. As well, Jeff Sove, I met him about 7.5 years ago, at Cemetery Stories in 2017, where he was portraying a character there. They are both wonderful people, very knowledgeable about local history, and so I'm very excited to be able to talk with not one, but both of them here today. They're both local history virtuosos. Who better than to take us through the band's history than Susan Vistendahl and Jeff Sove? We're heading back in time to discover the history of the St. Olaf Band. Welcome, Susan and Jeff, to the Time Machine. Thank you very much for trekking through time with me today. I'm excited to talk to you both.
Well, we're excited as well.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, that includes me, too.
That's great. When I first started this podcast, I put together a list of potential guests I wanted to interview. And needless to say, you were both on that list. But I didn't expect to interview you both together right away, so this is double the fun. Both of you are well-known history virtuosos in town. Both of you, I imagine, get a lot of questions historically. But overall, I think most people know who you are, but if you just kind of want to sum up Susan Vistendahl and Jeff Sove in your own words for us.
Okay, well, my background is that I'm from Brookings, South Dakota. And I went to St. Olaf, and I graduated in 68. I was a Spanish major, went on to get a master's at Iowa State in English. And out in New York, I was a freelance writer and also a Spanish teacher. I worked for Roger Kahn, who was a Boys of Summer author, so I got to interview a lot of Hall of Fame baseball players. I returned back here to Northfield in 2004 because my brother David and my mother Marion were here. I did research for the Historical Society during the sesquicentennial. And then from 2007 to 2016, I wrote a Historic Happenings column for the Entertainment Guide, 119 of them, which resulted in 4 books, Historic Happenings, Northfield, St. Olaf, Carlton, and then the Band Book in 2019 with my friend Jeff here.
Yeah,
Yeah.
This is a good segue into you, Jeff.
All right. Yes. Well, I was born and raised in Burnsville, Minnesota, and graduated from there in 1983. After graduating from the University of Minnesota, I was a Control Data Corporation archivist for the next 10, 15 years. That corporation basically folded by the late 1990s, and I was looking for something to do. My wife, Evelyn Hoover, had been appointed the managing editor of the Northfield News at this point, so we moved down to town here, and I took a job at Carleton, working in their development office. Shortly after that, there was an opening in the college archives at St. Olaf, and I served from 1999 to 2019. Various capacities. I eventually was the senior archivist, as well as the archivist for the Norwegian American Historical Association. I wore many hats here at the museum. I was the museum archivist. I was on the board. I think I did about everything. I was curator even after retirement. So when I was at St. Olaf, of course, I had a master's degree in creative writing, and I thought, what a better way to try tell history then just started writing little tidbits for the college. Those tidbits were finally like in the magazines. And then I eventually had a career writing. And so I ended up publishing about a dozen books, some for the college, some for other historical associations like Northfield Historical Society. And then right around 2016 or so is when Susan and I ventured on this book project, the St. Olaf Band History.
Well, I don't know why I'm even here, because you guys are perfectly segueing into the topic at hand, the history of the St. Olaf Band. So yeah, with both of your writing experience combined, it was only a matter of time before you two collaborated, I would imagine. And this seemed like the perfect project for it, the impetus to finally come together, as the Beatles might say. Susan, maybe you want to touch on the process of when this idea first became a reality.
Well, the college was celebrating the 125th year of the St. Olaf Band in 2016, and the band was planning to play at Carnegie Hall in February of 2016 under Tim Marr. And I wrote about him. I interviewed him before that for one of my entertainment guide columns. And later on, he approached me. He said he wanted a band history. The choir had one. Joe Shaw had written one way back in 1997. And the band had preceded the choir, as right. Jeff will tell you. And so it was just time he felt that there should be a book about the band. And I said, well, I would only do it if Jeff could help me out, because Jeff Sove had the the archival material
expertise,
that could really help me out. And we made an announcement that during the band's reunion week in 2016 at a gala banquet, got much applause. And I think Jeff can tell you how he decided he would do this.
Yeah, what was your reaction to being approached, Jeff?
Well, I was kind of stunned because... You know, as a college archivist, I was supposed to be knowledgeable in all aspects of the college's history, but I just didn't really know that much about the St. Olaf Band. Mm-hmm. And I've never played an instrument. I don't know how to read notes. I thought, well, I'm going to be going into a territory that's pretty unknown to me. But Susan and I had worked together on a few other historical projects and leading up to that, and at that time, the college, since it was planning the 125th anniversary, and they said, Jeff, why don't you put together a little exhibit for the band so everyone comes see it? So that gave me an opportunity to really organize the archive files, quickly learn its history, and I became sort of a pseudo expert. And I really enjoyed, you know, as I was trying to tell the story through the exhibit, I was also learning the story of the band, and
right.
I would contact Susan and say, did you know that in 1906, did you know? And so I think when you have those aha moments, that's when history really comes alive. And for me, mm-hmm. you know, it just seemed like the natural progression when they said, would you like to write this book together? And I was very grateful for Susan for asking, because Tim Marr had asked Susan to do it. And for you to just say, I'm going to tap Jeff. So we became partners for the next several years. It was an extensive project. You know, she says 600 pages. It's a tome. It's a well-documented history. And
yes.
That doesn't just come within a year.
Right. Yeah. It's a long process because I love reading history books. At the end, I'm always stunned by how many pages of footnotes there are. Wow. You really have to be a patient person and an organized person to undertake that. I think you both fit that description pretty well. Susan, what was your knowledge of the band's history like before coming on to write this book with Jeff then?
Yeah, well, I certainly had my own background of the band,
right?
Because I had been in the St. Olaf Band starting my freshman year in 1964. Mighty Johnson, Miles Johnson, was the band conductor, and he also conducted the Varsity Band, and that was a band that people who didn't make it or didn't just wanted to do it, you know, part-time were in. And I hadn't even thought of being in the St. Olaf Band, but it turned out that they needed an alto clarinetist, and that was me, so I was able to be in it. So I had that background with the band, and as I'll probably talk about later, I was fortunate to go with the band to Germany, Norway, and Denmark in 1966. I have to say, in terms of the process of the research, mm-hmm. I had to give credit to Jeff mostly for that, because he had those year-by-year folders, past programs, Managel Messenger columns, you know, accounts. I was fortunate because I was able to tape Myrna Johnson, who was the wife of my band conductor, who was still in town here in Northfield and went on all the tours. And Miles Johnson was the conductor from 1957 to 1994. And then Tim Marr was here. He took over in 1994, of course, and so I talked to him. And I was fortunate to have many in-person and telephone interviews. Jeff, because he covered covered the beginnings of the band up to the arrival of Miles Johnson. And so mm-hmm. not as many people were alive that he could talk to. So I was fortunate. Yeah, so I had these in-person interviews, and the chapters I covered were year by year so that the readers could find highlights of their time. And I included names of the concert pieces, and they're still used as a source for Henry Dorn, who's the new conductor, to look back over, you know, right. What was played during those times.
So, Susan, personally, I would love to see your Google Contacts folder, because with all of the columns you've written, you've probably talked to a lot of people across the years. And then, Jeff, maybe you want to touch on your own research process, having been at St. Olaf College already for almost 20 years.
Right. Excellent question. You know, being an archivist is really being a sleuth. You have to be a detective and go through things. And you should never, as an historian, rely upon identification on the back of a photo saying this was 1933, mm-hmm. when you may think it could be 1906. And so first I had to organize the archives, get all the band material in a year-by-year chronological order. So
did they call you the cleaner?
You do clean. You find that you don't need 12 copies of the same program. And then you find that I had umpteen photographs from the early years, early 1900. And I would say invariably many of them were misdated. But there were a few small band histories published, and everyone based their histories on these early documents. Unfortunately, the person who wrote the very first one in about 1908 got a number of items wrong. Mm. You know, they didn't have access to the 1890 letter books of the president or mm-hmm. other materials that I did as the archivist who would someone had curated all this over time. So I started finding, you know, these threads. Is this the truth? Is this really what happened? And so I had to kind of, you know, as a historian, you have to tap into that and really kind of prove, is this accurate or not? Started, as Susan mentioned, well, she had living living people to tell her the story. You know, I was fortunate, since I was covering up to the mid-50s, there were alums, there still are alums from that era, and even going back to the 30s. And I would write them letters, or I would call them, or especially at reunion time, I would say, all right, the class of 1945 is meeting. And I would make a point of trying to just touch base and just say, well, what was it like under Donald Berglund? Or, you know, but I think it was 1995 or so, or maybe even a little earlier, 91. There was some sort of band reunion at that point. They filled out like a little survey, mm-hmm. you know, like what was your student days like in the band? And that was an excellent document.
I'm sure.
So, yeah. So the research process was, for me, at least I had it right at my fingertips. I was able to go through the collections and organize and try to create a systematic note-taking. You'll find, you said, extensive footnotes. Well, I think
we wanted to
make sure that we validated what we were stating, because someone might say, well, that conflicts.
I wanted to make a note that Jeff and I were really a collaborative on this. We read and made comments on each other's chapters, chapter by chapter, for the whole book. You know, it was a big enterprise, 600 pages and 56 pages of meticulous footnotes at the end, and we checked everything.
Susan, maybe you want to touch on a little bit collaboration in terms of not just with Jeff, but with your editor who you hired, St. Olaf, by all means.
Yeah, we had an editor named Ann Solly, class of 95, who was in Tim Marr's first band at St. Olaf, and she was willing to do the editing, which was great. And we went with local Northfield publisher, Rob Shanlack of By All Means Graphics. Credit also Ronica Roberson, who did the layout. I might point out that Jeff did a wonderful book on the St. Olaf History Theater later with By All Means Graphics as well.
I've seen that there before. So, Jeff, how did you rely on promoting it and getting the word out about it?
I look back, it was 2019,
wasn't December it? December 2019.
Well, and our first talk was held here at the museum.
We were also at Winter Walk signing.
Oh, okay.
But no talk.
And so things were really starting to roll along. You know, we're starting to get things. And then all of a sudden comes spring, when we were planning a spring, summer, you know, a vintage band festival and all these
COVID
activities.
COVID hit in March.
COVID hit. We were really stymied. Mm-hmm. We had this wonderful book. It wasn't gaining the attention it should. Susan lined up, I think, NPR Radio.
There's a picture of us being interviewed in Bridge Square, both of us wearing our face masks. Mm-hmm. But we were interviewed with the Minnesota Public Radio, so that gave the book exposure. But we mostly relied on social media to spread the word.
Well, as for the NPR Radio interview, that one was probably a little bit more high caliber than this interview, but I hope I can rival it in some way, but we'll see. So
one day they'll say, he was on the Cosmo Show.
The Cosmo Show. Maybe I should change the title of Trek Through Time to the Cosmo Show. But, I just want to commend you on the book itself, because I got it for Christmas. At first, I'll admit, I was a little bit intimidated because it's a thick book, but I really breezed through it, actually, because once you get rolling and you start understanding the history of this band and the institution and the impact it has on Northfield, on St. Olaf, on college bands nationwide, you really, you kind of get sucked into the story, and it's really fun to see how it progresses throughout the eras. And so it was a really great read, and I would I don't have a Cosmo book club like Oprah does, but I would put it on there for a top recommendation. So
thank you.
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed it. So, and now I kind of want to, you know, zoom back even further and get both of your perspectives on the history of the actual band itself. So we can kind of run over the 130 years of history. So
we'll pack it in.
First of all, I'm going to start with you, Jeff, because you covered the first 50 years, I believe, 50 to 60 years.
1891 to 1957.
60 plus years, yeah.
Yeah, 66 years. And then I'll come back to you, Susan, because you covered the latter half of it. So first of all, Jeff, just kind of tell us a little bit about like the founding of the band and what spurred that.
It's a fun story because St. Olaf at the time in 1891, I mean, it was a small college. It had an academic department, so a high school component as well as a college course. About 14 young men decided in October of 1891 that maybe they should have a band. Now, they met in the Tower of Old Main. So if you ever drive by down there and look up and think that's where St. Olaf band at least got its beginnings. Only one of the 14 students, the so-called founder, Engelbert Lee, could read notes. They didn't have, two or three instruments at best? So they thought, okay, well, we're going to have a band, but we need instruments.
That is an important part.
Yeah, and so the thread that I like to tell is that Northfield had a city brass band in the late 1880s, early 1890s, which for whatever reason, the man who was in charge of that, he ended up going to Michigan to dental school. The instruments then from the city players ended up going to Carleton. Carleton had a band leading up to about 1891. But, you know, as with students and graduations and everything, the band sort of just folded and they said, hey, St. Olaf, if you're interested, come get our instruments. And so that's how it began. Those early years, if you look at from the early 1890s, really up to almost 1900, the student conductor, director, as they would later say, was always a student. Sometimes it would be a high school student in the academy. Wow. They were innovative. They would do fun things. For instance, when the telephone was installed in Northfield in the mid-1890s, the St. Olaf band members thought, wouldn't it be a hoot if we played musical selections over the telephone? So they went down to like the telephone office.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Anyone who had a telephone in town could listen in, kind of like the original party line. And they played their sweet music over the lines. The band would be involved in a lot of community events because they didn't really have a band in town, as I said. Mm-hmm. It had folded. So the St. Olaf band was really much a de facto band for the community. So they were called upon to perform for parades, funerals, inaugurations at Carleton, you name it. The band was always there. And everyone said, oh, they're one of the best things Northfield has to offer.
Mm.
I think that was a quote from 1899 or so, wasn't it, Susan?
Mm-hmm. 8 years in only.
Yeah. The real change started happening by the 1890s. A student had come from Norway just a few years earlier, Andrew Onsted. He was an older student. He's 26 years old, and he's in the high school department at St. Olaf. But he knows how to play the clarinet with that boy. He was top notch. After a while, he said, why don't you be the conductor of the band? And then he had graduated from the academy, and he got hired in Kenyon to be the head of the Kenyon City Band. But St. Olaf students were like, well, we really miss you, Mr. Onsted. Come back. So on weekends and on Mondays and his day off, he'd take the train up to Northfield. And for the next few years, he would basically, as a volunteer, lead the band. So you can see for the first 9 years, they're just sort of a, you know, they're just an informal student-led group. But mm-hmm. then Onsted's finally hired by the college to be its official first staff member to actually be the director. He does that for the next few years, but, you know, they're not really making strides. And then it's 1903. It's a milestone in the band. F. Melius Christiansen.
Christiansen.
Yes.
That's good to know. I've pronounced so many names wrong when I do this show because I thought it was Christiansen. So, Norwegian.
He had immigrated from Norway and he'd been working up at Augsburg. And all of a sudden, you know, they said, can you work down here in Northfield part time? Can you like help with the music department? They didn't have a very strong music department. And can you like lead the band? Okay, I'll do that. And so he was coming, going by train. But then he started seeing the possibilities to really reshape St. Olaf. He created this music department that has now made the college probably its foremost identity, right? Mm-hmm. Music at St. Olaf. And he spearheaded the band and made them not just a regionally known band or beyond the greater Northwest. In time, in the next 10 years, they become internationally known. And it's all due to F. Melius. From that point on, the band is now, it's got prestige. It's recognized as one of the preeminent collegiate bands in the nation. The band sort of morphs. We get to the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. Well, by now, F. Melius, you know, he'd kind of started the St. Olaf Choir.
Yes.
And by 1911, you know, they got the initial founding of the choir. And by 1920, he's taken them on a big tour out east. And the college is like, we really need to invest our energy and time and money in the choir. Someone's going to have to suffer. Well, the ensemble that doesn't benefit is the band.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, F. Melius says, I don't have enough energy bandwidth to manage the choir and the band. So he turns over the band to an alum, Jack Burke, who had graduated, I think, around 1904, and he'd been in the band. Jack was instrumental in, well, you know, it's hard to fill shoes like F. Malleus. So Jack thought, how can I differentiate the style of the St. Elf band? He insisted that every member memorize the entire program. No sheet music.
Yeah, right, right.
Well, I don't know if this bothered F. Malleus because the band was really getting a lot of publicity. They were considered the best collegiate band in the Upper Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
By 1927, F. Malleus says, you know what? I'm in charge of the music department. There isn't enough money, really. Sorry, you're not touring anymore. And the band really floundered. And so from the 27 era till really to the mid-50s, the band just kept going down downhill. I hope that gives you kind of a picture. The band, you know, for all of its recognition, you know, you go on a roller coaster with them. And I think the book shows that.
Yes.
It's the one thing about college, you know, every 4 years, you're going to lose students and you got to start all over. And the college was always kind of reinventing how the band should be. I think Susan, she did a marvelous job because when Mighty Johnson comes on board, it's not just someone who's going to carry on the traditions. Mighty's going to reestablish the band.
This still does work as a segue, Mighty Johnson, because one of the things that Johnson did when he came in was focus a lot on tours. Probably the most well-known tour in band history is the 1906 Norway tour.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So if you want to take us through that a little bit.
Yeah. The 1906 band tour, for those that are listening and are unaware, it was the first time in U.S. history that a collegiate ensemble played abroad.
That's wild.
F. Malleus, you know, it all started, the whole idea came about in 1905, the year before the tour, an ensemble, a group from Oslo, college boys, came over and St. Olaf entertained them. And their director said, hey, if you're ever in Norway, stop on by and play for us. And so that kind of got the wheels spinning. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, F. Malleus had just arrived at St. Olaf in 1903. So this is really ambitious to say, I'm going to reshape the band and they're going to be good enough to go to Norway. They had 48 members. They went abroad and they played in, I forget, 30-plus concerts. They played for their majesties. The Kaiser of Germany was on his yacht in the harbor, and they played for him. I guess they said over 60,000 people attended the concerts throughout. But it was more of a homecoming, too. F. Malleus, you know, had immigrated from Norway. A lot of the students were of Norwegian descent. They had never been to the old country. And so they were told, if you're in Telemark, look up your grandmother that you have never met. And so there's some really wonderful, heart-rendering stories of these students who only have a few hours in between concerts or whatever to go visit, you know, grandparents or cousins, and they'll never see them again, but at least touching base. And for Norway, they were so thrilled because Norwegians who've made it big in America, the promise held true. And look how wonderful they are coming home fresh-faced and playing these tunes. And it really was a wonderful experience. And one thing that F. Malleus wanted the students to do was keep journals. We had in the college archives, I think, about 5 or 6 student journals that were kept on the tour. They give you a really, and so I hopefully captured that in the book, you know. What was it like for these young men to be on a boat crossing the Atlantic? What was it like to perform in front of the king and queen of Norway? You know, a lot of these kids grew up in like Blooming Prairie, Minnesota.
Where I'm from, actually.
Oh, get out of town! Yeah.
So, talk about segues, right?
Yeah. So it was really... After that experience, there was no bounds to what St. Olaf band could do.
Right. One of the things that I found fascinating, going back to the subject of Blooming Prairie briefly, is that in the book, they played at a venue in Blooming Prairie. I'm not sure where this would have been, actually, but the stage wasn't big enough for them.
Oh, right. So, right. Some of them were on the stage and some were playing below.
Yeah, exactly. So you got to get comfortable with all the different accommodations, quote unquote. One other thing that I want to mention before I turn it over to Susan to look at the back half of the 20th century. When the band was being formed,
I thought one of the funniest parts was that the Carleton students didn't want to use the instruments because there was a rumor going around that it would make them unattractive.
Yeah, they didn't want to use the instruments because it might disfigure their pretty Yankee faces.
Those beautiful Carls,
beautiful Carls.
Yeah. It's too bad for them. They missed out on quite an opportunity, apparently. So it is definitely an American institution, but with a lot of Norwegian influence. So on that thread, Susan, let's talk about Miles H. Mighty Johnson, who just until about 20 minutes ago, I thought it was pronounced Mitty the whole time. So I apologize.
No, that's Mighty.
So what influence did he bring to the band in terms of changing their path along history, if you will?
Well, I'll tell you that he came to St. Olaf in 1957 from Elbow Lake, Minnesota. He graduated from Concordia College in Moorhead, and that's where he met Myrna. And after a career service, he taught music in Holly, Minnesota, and he got the job at St. Olaf because of F. Melius Christiansen's son, Olaf Christiansen, who was the leader of music at St. Olaf. And he was recommended by his brother, Paul, who was up at Concordia. And he was hired. There wasn't any looking, as they have to do nowadays. Mighty was said to have boundless energy. The one thing they asked was that there would be a tour. There'd been no band tour since 54, and they had had no abroad tours since that 1906 tour. In 1966, I was fortunate to be able to go along with the St. Olaf band then to that 1966 tour. We went to Norway, where the 1906 band had gone, but we also had Germany and Denmark. We were a concert band. We were expected to march just like that 1906 band had done. So we practiced marching on St. Olaf Avenue. At any rate, so this was the thing that he brought to it immediately, was being able to expand the influence and reach of the St. Olaf band. With our tour, we got absolutely fabulous reviews all the way along the way. Our conductor and band president got to meet King Olav at the University of Oslo there and played in the magnificent Trondheim Nidaros Cathedral, where has the gravesite there of our founder, B.J. Moose. And we ended up further north in the Land of the Midnight Sun, which included the North Norway Music Festival in Harstad, where we outdrew the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra.
That's pretty cool.
So anyway, this continued. He was able to travel to do a lot of tours after that. I was impressed by remembering as I looked through my scrapbook recently, we played in outdoor venues, concert halls, cathedrals. We had 15 concert works, 12 marches, 10 Broadway musicals, folk music, national songs of the country we visited. We traveled 8,000 miles with 27 concerts in 30 days and all those great reviews. And another thing that he brought, that Mighty brought to the way that the St. Olaf band played, started in 1970 when they had a Western and Eastern Europe tour. And his wife, Myrna Johnson, had an influence as the founder of the Northfield Arts Guild. She brought in theatrical multimedia touches. And the theme in 1970 was a Window on America theme. And here you had band members singing folk rock songs, doing a rock dance number, marching down the aisle, playing 76 trombones, having other Broadway melodies to which the band sang, a slideshow of artwork and things of that nature. So, you did mention that he expanded the opportunities for the band, and that probably was one of the major things. And also the appreciation for concert music, because a lot, like when we went to Norway, they weren't used to concert bands. They were used to marching bands and, playing marching type music. And we had a spectacular concert band with a soprano named Irene Gubrud, who went on to success in New York City. And
you have
and
a
so
couple
on.
Columns about her, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. She was amazing. I should mention, 1975-76 was Tim Marr's first year with the band. There was a January interim in England that he went on. And a 1978 tour, his senior year, with a Civil War cannon for the 1812 Overture, which set off fire alarms.
Things seemed to get really wild in the 60s and 70s around that time, kind of a microcosm of American culture.
1994 was when Tim Marr took over. He was at the U of M, Duluth at that time, and he was the successor, and he started in September of 94. And he really expanded the opportunities for the band as well. And he was a composer, so that was even an additional opportunity for the band to show off their talents. In addition to making Norway tours, he had a special trip to Mexico because they brought instruments so that the small town in Mexico would be able to start their own band. And and in Japan, he's been with the band to Japan twice. He's considered a rock star over there, composer. And of course, the concert in Carnegie Hall that we mentioned in association with the band's 125th anniversary, that was one of the highlights for him. And our band book ends with the study tour of New Zealand and Australia in 2018.
So, Susan, I'm curious because you read about these figures in these books, you know, Mighty Johnson being one of them, kind of a very instrumental character, instrumental, no pun intended. But I had to go for that one. Can you give us a little bit of like your experience, you know, knowing Mighty and Myrna as a student during that time?
Well, Myrna went along with us, along with their daughter, Sarah, who was 10 years old at that time. And when I moved back to Northfield in 2004 from New York, Myrna was here. Miles Johnson, unfortunately, died that summer of Alzheimer's, so I didn't get to reunite with him. But I did reunite with Myrna, and now this 10-year-old had, well, Sarah was much older, of course, and so... That was wonderful. And I was able to, you know, reconnect with Myrna on a different level, being a student versus being someone who was interviewing her about her whole experience with the band. And they were a wonderful couple, and they opened their home to students to come. Probably I should mention the camaraderie that exists among band members, which was promoted by Mighty and Myrna and by Tim and Jill as well. There's just nothing like it, the appreciation that we all had as students playing music together, traditions that resulted as... I was looking at a tour booklet the other day. These are booklets that were made up right before tour, and they were like suggestions of questions that you could ask for conversation starters on bus tours. Do you have any cow stories? The trumpet section once included the number of mute drops that they were made. There was disco dancing in the bus aisles and no talent skit shows, and they had things like big hair night and crazy makeup nights and devotions that are held before the concerts and so forth. And these are things which the band conductor made sure that the students could avail themselves of opportunities to get to know other people and to appreciate wonderful music too as well, concert music.
It's almost as if there's two separate incidents where the St. Olaf band really started, if you will. The first one was in 1891 with F. Malleus, Chris Johnson.
He didn't come along until 1903. Yeah. But basically, you could say that.
Right, that era, if you will. And then I would say the second part of that would be when Mighty Johnson arrives, because that's really when a lot of these traditions start rolling and become staples of really St. Olaf culture. So, we've really dug into a great general overview of the band. I don't think you guys could have done a better job really summarizing its impact across 134 years. One thing that I always do right before the end of the interview, I think you both know what's coming.
We both look tense,
terrified. The rapid fire round. These are quick questions followed by quick responses. Best of luck to you both. Well, all I should call it the lightning round too, because I always do a lightning sound effect.
Be gentle.
Okay. I will. Okay. First of all, favorite orchestral piece of music?
Tricico by Václav Nelibel. I'm not sure you call it classical. It was so revolutionary in its time. And I was just absolutely amazed when we had to play that my freshman year. And it's so interesting.
Jeff, you mentioned that you didn't play an instrument. You didn't know how to read music beforehand. Do you have at least a genre of orchestral music that you find appealing?
I just don't have an ear for music. People would say that, so I'm going to pass.
All right. Well, that's their first pass of the rapid fire round. Look, I understand that because this book also familiarized me with different pieces of orchestral music, because I did not know that before. And now I listen to NPR classical a lot while I'm studying for school. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. Susan, do you have a favorite composer? Is it that Tritical guy or whatever his name is?
Yes, Václav Nelibel. Uh-huh. He actually came to St. Olaf some years after after we learned this piece, and we had it in sheet music. So we were one of the first ones that played it, and it became, you know, a standard for bands. And so I have to say that was really my favorite composer, especially during my time.
Jeff, you said you didn't have an ear for music. Is there any type of music genre outside the orchestral sphere?
I love music, but I don't have a passion for any particular okay. genre. Yeah. You know, I'll ask Alexa at home, you know, play me Stravinsky or play me, you know. So,
Susan, do you have a favorite non-Oli band? And it doesn't have to be collegiate or anything. It can be even like a rock band or something like that.
Oh, okay. Well, mine is a college band called the Nightcrawlers in from Carleton College.
That's a good answer.
We went to dances to when we were in.
Right.
And I had some rock and roll oldies events with the Nightcrawlers and with Mark Regal here for several years. And that was a lot of fun to put together.
The Nightcrawlers is kind of the very much juxtaposed with the St. Olaf band. Last rapid fire one here. Let's see if we can get you in this, Jeff.
I'm failing at this. I'm just failing.
It's fine. You know,
I'm sorry, folks.
Favorite fact about the St. Olaf band?
What's amazing is that I didn't realize when I started the research that the first women weren't in the band till 1920.
Mm.
30 years had passed. And I was wondering, well, why? Was there like a rule against having women involved? And I looked it up, and the band minutes from that time said, well, we didn't have any rule against women, just it was sort of just the tradition of men being in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, they don't see a problem. And so from that point on, you always see a woman, at least I'm looking right now at a 1924 program. And on the back, I find out of the 20-odd members of the band, there is a woman.
How about you, Susan? You have a fun fact that you like to pull out every once in a while?
Just the fact that I was a part of the band.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm very, very proud of the fact that I was able to be in the St. Olaf band and that I was able to then be part of its history by writing this book with Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
That really is it.
That's a nice legacy that you have there, Susan.
Yeah, it's you both have definitely left a legacy in terms of this book, because I didn't realize this is the first book that is, you know, a biography of the St. Olaf Band, is it not?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a pretty neat thing to have etched your names in the history of the band itself. So, well, before we depart, you guys have any other events coming up or anything that you want to note to the audience that you're working on?
I think, first of all, I think we need to do a plug for where the band book is on sale in town. By all means, Graphics Online and Graphic Mailbox, the Northfield History Center, Content Bookstore, the Northfield Arts Guild.
Very accessible.
You can pick up, and online as well with our publisher.
Jeff, you had mentioned before we went on air that you just finished up another book project. Are you able to talk about that, or are those NDAs still in effect right now?
I haven't even come up with a title yet for this book, but it's another true crime book. I'm hoping that'll be out probably by next year. I had a lot of success with Murder at Minnesota Point.
Yes.
And so I'm still giving talks on that. In fact, last month I was at a dinner theater with 100 people, and it was broadcast on a half dozen radio stations throughout.
Wow.
So
that's fantastic.
You never know. Mid-June, for those that are interested, the Norwegian American Archives is hosting a conference, and I'm leading a bus tour through Rice and Goodhue County to Norwegian American historical sites. And Professor Dion Lagerquist from St. Olaf is leading a bus tour of Norwegian American churches. I do plan on putting together a book on the Northfield raid from a different perspective.
No one has.
Interesting. I'm looking at a bookshelf now with 60 books about Jesse James and the Younger Brothers' raid on the bank, but no one has ever written a book about the correspondent for the Minneapolis Tribune who basically embedded himself with the posse and wrote daily accounts for the Tribune. Mr. Nind, N-I-N-D. So I'm hoping to have that out for the 150th for 2026.
Wow, yeah. I'm looking forward to both of those projects. I'll definitely keep an eye out for those. How about you, Susan? You have any research projects right now? Or are you enjoying the retired life from doing the 190?
No, you can never completely retire. And, of course, mm-hmm. I do work with the Entertainment Guide. Both of us have a position with the Northfield. Mm-hmm. Well, no longer Northfield. Just Southern Minnesota Entertainment Guide, mm-hmm. which is having its 20th anniversary June of this year.
Wow.
I've started writing for them in 2007, and 2005 is when they started, Rob Chanelec started during the sesquicentennial year of Northfield. So I imagine I'll be doing some work along those lines too.
Great. Yeah. Well, we will look for your books, Jeff. We will look for the Entertainment Guide, Susan. And I want to thank you both very much for coming on and giving a concise and clear overview of the band, talking about your process for compiling the book. Both of you have been very supportive of me and this show, and I really appreciate that and for coming on today. So thank you.
Thank you, Cosmo.
Wow, we covered a lot of ground. That was great work there by our memoir maestros today. Thank you very much to Susan Vistendahl and Jeff Sove for coming in today and talking to me about their book. It was a great conversation and really insightful into one of Northfield's most beloved institutions. Also, thank you to Sean Allen, Mark Thornton, and Alexis Kraft at the Northfield History Center, and Rich Larson for broadcasting this at KYMN Radio. And, of course, my parents, who I always credit as the producers. So, please tune in tomorrow or stream it on Spotify. The bonus video content with Susan and Jeff will be available very soon, extra explorations. But until then, thank you very much for listening to Triple T today. I appreciate your time and attention. Come back tomorrow to hear the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey might say. It's a pretty old reference, but whatever. I will also be highlighting the pioneers of the past for this subject then. So, until then, this has been Voyage 13 of Trek Through Time. I'm your host, Cosmo Esplin, reminding you to make history happen.